I just don't want to ruin it by making it a Hollywood thing, you know, like an orchid heist movie or something, you know, or changing the orchids into poppies and turning it into a movie about drug running, you know? Why can't there be a movie simply about flowers?
You're listening to The Hollywood Saloon.
And why the f*** are you wasting my two precious hours with your movie?
Tracing the genesis of a masterpiece like Apocalypse Now yields no easy eureka. Its roots may be detected in a schoolroom in Colorado in 1962, where 17-year-old John Milius heard his English teacher, Erwin Blackler, extol the splendor of Conrad's novel, Heart of Darkness. Or in the pot-enriched gatherings at University of Southern California's film school 5 years later, when Milius's fellow students would listen quietly to his dreams of a film called The Psychedelic Soldier. Or around the same time when those very same students, John Milius, George Lucas, Walter Murch, Caleb Deschanel, William Hike, and others, would drive across town to Burbank. There, in the words of Francis Coppola, we sat around in my office on the Warner Brothers lot talking about our dreams. Obviously, many of them were trying to get their projects going. I recall George and John mentioning a lot of guys who were returning from Vietnam, bringing word of the craziness of it. The drugs, the hallucination, the surfing, and they were cooking up a script that John would write for George.
Never get out of the boat. Absolutely goddamn right.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Terminate. With extreme prejudice.
At the beginning of the scene where Deckard digitally scans Leon's snapshot into the Esper, two intrusive shafts of light come streaking in through Blade Runner's apartment window. The illumination source for these beams was xenon spotlights, commonly used for night advertising and sporting events. The Esper itself was the largest prop built by EEG's Mark Stetson and his miniature-making Blade Runner model crew. This machine was supposed to be Deckard's personal in-apartment extension of the police department's own Esper machine, a construct described in the 1982 Blade Runner production notes as a high-density computer with a very powerful three-dimensional resolution capacity and cryogenic cooling system, which can analyze and enlarge photos, enabling investigators to search a room without even being there.
Your hard copy right there.
Okay, and we are back, finally, after our long hiatus. Hey, this is Andy, and with me, of course, is the Human Film Database, John Jansen.
Welcome back, everyone.
All right, and so, we're back, and as you can tell, we're talking about something special. We're calling it Paper Cinema, and really what it is we're talking about, in this episode number 16 of The Hollywood Saloon, we're talking about film books, really behind-the-scene film books.
We're going back to the old school method. I mean, before the internet, whenever you wanted to learn about movies, these are the type of books that were available to sort of educate you and to, you know, fill your head with fantastic stories or harsh realities. These were the building blocks of inspiration.
Absolutely. And it's what you do. If you want to know more and you want to dig deeper and you want to find out more, that's what you do. You go, I mean, for me, when we were in school, it was, you know, just go to the library, you know, and there was that whole entertainment section with, and there was just an endless amount of books. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into that. But, you know, before we jump into this episode, I just want to make a quick announcement. And, you know, like I said, we're back from our, you know, pseudo hiatus that we've been gone for about a month and a half. We had to get some new equipment. We got some stuff. We got some stuff in order. So we're definitely coming back in there, full throttle, and we just wanted to give you guys something new as a thank you for hanging with us, hanging tough, and we're going to give you a twofer, okay? It's a two-for-one special going right now at the Hollywood Saloon. If you go to our main page, www.hollywoodsaloon.com, on the left side, you know, where we got all our links, you're going to see a new link there called Special Edition. And you go to that page, and boom, you're going to have all new content from us. And we're going to open that up. We're going to premiere a new show there. And it's a full episode of The Hollywood Saloon. And it's exclusive to that page, to the Special Edition page. You can't get it on iTunes or, you know, Podcast Pickle, Podcast Alley, any of those places. You got to come straight to the saloon and get it. So if you want it, come and get it. It's up. I think you're going to get a kick out of it. And it's all about our new Wall of Heroes. And there's a link to that, too, on the site. You'll see Wall of Heroes up there. And like I said, come check it out. It's exclusive here.
And it's also sort of our way of saying thank you.
Absolutely.
To all of you out there who have been downloading our 15 previous episodes and have been waiting for more content. This is sort of our way of saying, well, here you go.
Honestly, don't you two read?
I got a crap. I need something to read.
Apes don't read philosophy.
Yes, they do, Otto. They just don't understand it.
Hey, can't you read? Monday night's gay night.
Read between the lines, Theo. Read between the
lines! I'm fine. I just threw up in my mouth a little bit.
Yeah, you know, in some cultures, they only eat vomit. I've never been there, but I read about it in a book.
I read that book, too.
So let's take that book off the shelf, Andy.
Yeah.
Blow off that dust a little bit. Crack that spine.
When we look at film books and what it really is. I mean, what we were saying before is it's like, you know, it's an extension of a film. And back before the days of DVD, special features, you know, there was no commentary track. There was no, there was no behind the scenes making of that you could normally see.
Oh, no entertainment. Entertainment Tonight, there was no, you know, you rarely ever got to see what it would look like on a film set,
right.
You know. I mean, those were very rare little things. I mean, HBO was not in the habit of doing a lot of those yet, but it would happen. Right. You know, the 80s certainly would grow a lot of that, but it was primarily on the printed page where you were going to, you know, sort of get an education on, you know, the stories behind the making of the films.
Well, you know, and I did want to mention the passages at the beginning of this episode were from two books that we're looking at now. The first one was from a book called The Apocalypse Now book, which was written by Peter Cowie. And the second section was that you read, John, was from Future Noir, The Making of Blade Runner by Paul M. Salmon. I kind of wanted to open up the show. You know, and we're going to go through some books and look at different books and, you know, just talk about the whole idea. And it may sound boring at first, but you know, just trust us, it's not. I mean, if you are interested in film and wanting to know how movies come together, I mean, this is just, I mean, it's just a given. I mean, I don't know that I've met very many filmmakers that didn't just have, you know, shelves and shelves of books on directors and the making of process. I mean, to me, it's just one of the most fascinating things.
You have to chalk it up to research.
Sure.
You know, if you're going to make films, you got to do your homework. And if you're a filmmaker, one of the key ingredients that you can educate yourself on is the process that other films went through. You can learn a lot from the mistakes that were made, and hopefully you won't make some of the same ones, you know.
Sure.
There's been every case and every example already before you. So if you're going to get, if you want to be good, you know, I mean, what is it like Stanley Kubrick would say, you know, if you want to learn something about a subject, you read everything you can on it, you know, you immerse yourself in the materials and then you, you know, you can have an educated opinion about it.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. And I think for me, even as just a watcher, connoisseur of films, I think I've always found the making of process just fascinating, how it goes from, you know, just being an idea to something physical in the physical world. You know, and you know, as a filmmaker myself in the past, I mean, I've always been someone who could dream something up, but actually making that thing coming out of my head and into the world, that's someone who is a filmmaker. I mean, you know, it's one thing to be a dreamer, and that's great, but it's another thing to bring it into the world, to make it tangible. And I think that's, you know, that takes a very blessed and talented, amazing person to be able to do that. And yeah, sure, I love DVD behind the scenes and I love commentary tracks and all that kind of stuff. But if you really want to go deeper, I mean, you really want to get in there and dig, there are a lot, there's a lot of good printed material out there that you can get your hands on. You know, I personally am not really into books like, you know, how to be a filmmaker, you know, or how to be a director, or, you know, remember the one that we always had at college? Everyone had it. Like, making films at used car prices, you know.
Used car prices.
Yeah, right, you know, all those how-to books. They never really interested me. I mean, I'm not above that, definitely. I mean, there's always stuff to learn, but I've always been more interested in, you know, let's follow the story of Ridley Scott as he puts together this this film, Blade Runner. You know, I like to see those steps and how, you know, he worked with the design team, how he worked with, you know, Douglas Trumbull. I mean, that's fascinating stuff to me. And, you know, and if I'm just going to jump in and we're going to start our list, like I said, what we talked about just a minute ago, Future Noir, The Making of Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. I mean, what an incredible book. And I mean, this is a big, thick book. This is a 400-page book. You know, listen to the book.
Well, this is a template, sort of a blueprint, or, you know, a prime example of the kind of book you should make if you really want to do the definitive making of book on a single subject. I mean, it covers every aspect of the production, from the writing of the various drafts of the screenplay from both writers, from the hiring of the director, to all of the design work, to the casting process, to every single day of shooting is covered in one form or another. All the departments are covered in the book. And but best of all, what Salmon does really well is, since he was there as an insider on the making of the movie, he lists in exhaustive detail each of the different versions of Blade Runner.
Right.
From the very first test screenings that happened in San Diego and Dallas, to the other recut versions with the voiceover, all the way down to the director's cut that came out in 92, to the abortive director's cut that was never completed in time, to the revival of the work print cut of the film that came out in 1991 and sort of brought brand new interest in Blade Runner all over again. So this is a guy who's been there every stage of the production. And, well, he is the perfect guy. And, you know, a lot of this also appeared in, remember the old Video Watchdog magazines that used to come out? Yeah. You know, Salmon wrote for them as well. And so this is a guy who obviously loves the subject he's writing about. And best of all, he includes a new interview with Ridley Scott at the end of the book, you know, asking about every question you would want to ask about Blade Runner.
Yeah. You know, one thing I loved about this book, and you had hooked me up with this book, I didn't. You told me for the longest time, got to get it, got to get it, got to get it. And so, you know, I went to good old Amazon and picked it up. And it is just a fantastic book. I mean, like you said, I mean, I can't really cover it better than you did there. You know, it has everything that you need to know about Blade Runner. And, you know, it's full of pictures, it's and all that stuff. And I think it's just a fantastic read. And I think for me, just, you know, the overall feel, I can't get enough of things like, you know, how the ideas process came in. You know, when they're sitting there talking about, you know, how do we create this world? And I mean, if any movie is a movie about environment, it is Blade Runner. I mean, you know, it's such a visionary film. You know, when you look across in the opening scenes, you know, where you see the fire exploding, you know, over Los Angeles with these massive buildings. I mean, really, it's an incredible, just a visual festival for the eyes. You know what I mean? And to see how that came into being in the modeling and the idea process, and what was the guy's name who, it's like they hired Sid Mead, is that it? No.
Sid Mead, the futurist.
Yeah, the futurist guy. And he, you know, he just dreamed it all up, did his sketches.
Lawrence G. Paul, I believe, was another designer on the film.
You know, and it's just amazing stuff. And to see that whole process come to being from just idea to, you know, to whittling it down to the film. And I think another thing that's very interesting about the movie is, you know, this book had years before it came out. It's not like one of those deals where they put out the book and they put, you know, that releases the same time as the film.
Well, the book came out, I think, in 96.
Yeah.
So 95, 96.
It's 10 years old, but, you know, years and years and, you know, a decade after, you know, the film was released, basically.
Mm-hmm. It's as exhaustively researched as any book will ever be on Blade Runner.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, if another book is written on Blade Runner, they're going to have to credit Paul Salmon because all the information's in this book.
Right, it's there. I mean, you don't need to. I mean, that's it. That's the definitive version. So, I mean, really, it's like if you ever needed to have the definitive version of a film, you know, in that one day when that, you know, super, you know, four disc set of Blade Runner ever comes out, you know what? This book needs to be in your collection too. It needs to be a part of that DVD set, because if you really want to get in there and find it out, you got to go this route too. But you know, it's amazing that Blade Runner really wasn't a hit when it first came out. I mean, it just kind of came and went and didn't get a lot of critical raves. And you know, it took years, but you know, finally it got the credit it deserves.
Well, that's also, Salmon talks about that. There wasn't really a market for making a Blade Runner book for a long time.
Right.
And
it had to grow on home video.
But thankfully, you know, he persevered for all of us. I think also, too, that any fan out there of Philip K. Dick's work can finally get the question answered. You know, what did Philip K. Dick think of the film? And, you know, Salmon does talk about, you know, there was some strained relationships between Philip K. Dick and the producers and the writers. He didn't really like a lot of the changes they were making, and he felt like the central theme of his novel was not being translated, you know, in the film. But he was invited to come in and take a look, and they put together like a 14-minute showreel of all the best effects stuff. And I think it was like a lot of the opening shot, and they had some Vangelis music scored to it. And, you know, Dick sat down and he got to watch just what Ridley had done. And, you know, he was so stunned, he wanted to watch it twice. But basically, he felt like he couldn't figure out how Ridley Scott had gotten inside his brain and translated what his vision of the future was like on film.
Well.
He was very suspicious. But needless to say, I think he liked what he saw. He never got to see the completed film, unfortunately.
Right.
But Salmon's reporting is right on. It's a fun read. And anyone that appreciates Blade Runner will find a lot more to look at inside the film when they watch it again.
Absolutely. And, you know, just so you know, on the Hollywood Saloon, we will have links to all these books that we talk about. Don't worry, we got you covered there, so, you know, you can put your pens down. But, yeah, great book, amazing. Why don't you give me another book?
Well, the book I'm going to talk about is one of the very first books I remember reading that really influenced me a great deal, and it was given to me by my uncle, and he knew I had an interest in making movies, and he said, well, you ought to read this, and it was called Final Cut by Stephen Bock.
Great.
And it had a subtitle at the time called Dreams and Disasters in the Making of Heaven's Gate. And Heaven's Gate was one of those films that I only really knew by reputation. At that time, I'd never seen it, you know, but God, if anyone was paying attention in the early 80s, everyone knew Heaven's Gate. It was almost synonymous with the word bomb, massive flop or failure on a massive scale.
Yep.
But this book, Stephen Bock was an executive at United Artists, and he was the man that not only hired Tremito and greenlit the film, but saw it go through all its different phases of production all the way through release. And he's written a book that not only is about the making of the film, but it's also about United Artists during one of the greatest creative periods that that company was going through. I mean, it traces the production roots of everything from what Woody Allen was doing with the studio at the time, from Annie Hall to Interiors to Manhattan to Stardust Memories. What the Rocky films were going on at the time, you know, from Rocky and Rocky II, through Martin Scorsese and De Niro's attempts to get Raging Bull made. All of this is also chronicled in the book. In fact, the first couple of chapters are a history of United Artists. Mm-hmm. And it might seem kind of slow for people that aren't interested in the history of United Artists, but it's important to note the history of that studio was founded by four filmmakers. And the principle behind the company was artistic freedom.
Right.
And that theme is very important when you get to the Michael Cimino story, because this is a man who started out in advertising and was quite brilliant at it, and then entered Hollywood, wrote a couple of scripts, worked on the Magnum Force screenplay, and also Silent Running, then wrote a little script called Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, and Clint Eastwood let him direct it. And through that, he'd made another little film called The Deer Hunter. And on the night that he was collecting an Oscar for Best Director, the next day he was going on the set to direct his next film, Heaven's Gate. He was in an extraordinary position for a very young filmmaker. Right. He had only made two films primary to that, and was courted by United Artists. They wanted the film, They wanted an Oscar prestige type film, and this is a man that had just delivered one, Who wouldn't want the next Michael Cimino picture after seeing Deer Hunter?
Right.
And how did it become, the most expensive film or one of the most expensive film during its time? It's all chronicled. And it is a great tale of ego, of greed and sort of production run rampant, but it's also a great tale of an artist who was completely uncompromising for the film he wanted to make. And what I found so exciting is, when I read the book, I was completely enthralled of all the behind-the-scenes stories and the stunts Cimino was pulling in order to get his film made, and just the fact that he would sit there all day, if necessary, just to get the right clouds, the right light, the right everything in the frame. Mm-hmm. It was all about the frame for him. But I couldn't wait to see the film after reading the book. It really sparked my interest in seeing the film. And I remember renting the full long 3-hour, 42-minute version. And I remember being quite taken with it. Mm-hmm. Not that it's a perfect movie. It does have certain flaws. But when you watch the artistic aspect of filmmaking, it's a stunning piece of work. Every frame in that movie is impeccably composed. It's visual poetry. It's a tone poem of a different time.
Well, then what was all the bad press about? What was the bitch?
Well, you got to remember, this was a time where it was a movie that was reviewed on its budget, not really on what it was.
Right.
And come on, it's a 3-hour, 42-minute movie that moves very slow.
Yeah.
Its story could easily be told in 90 minutes, but Cimino wasn't interested in that. He was interested in the larger canvas. He was interested in the big roller skating scene, because that's what was going on during those time periods.
Well, do you remember when Waterworld started getting in trouble, mm-hmm. and they started calling it Kevin's Gate?
Well, that was Dances with Wolves also.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And they just wanted to be able to use that name.
Sure. Well, there's a story also, and it's chronicled in the book. Basically, Cimino wouldn't let anybody on the set, gave no interviews, and was completely shielded out the press. Uh-huh. So what happened was, is a member of the press took a job undercover as an extra on the film, and then wrote a big expose scoop of just all of the problems that were going on in the movie.
Right.
And that story got picked up all over the place, and suddenly Heaven's Gate was, out of control.
And at that time,
instead of, getting ahead of the story, which any good press agent would have done, they didn't. And it snowballed, out of favor of the film. The film has its detractors for sure, but it also has its admirers.
Right.
I've heard Martin Scorsese, talk highly about it on several occasions. Uh-huh. But don't take his word for it, and don't take mine. You should go out and rent the widescreen version of the film after you read the book, of course,
yeah.
and decide for yourself. There's really been nothing quite that ambitious made, since then. And, who knows if there ever will be. But every single frame is absolutely authentic.
Right.
And you'll get the feeling that, this is what it was like. It's a dirty picture. There's yeah. dust everywhere. And there's a great chapter in the book where, after all of the problems of production, and there were a lot of problems making that movie. It was way over budget after a week of filming. Stephen Bock talks about the first time he sat down to watch the first cut of the movie, and Cimino walks in and says, it's a little long. I'm going to trim about 15 minutes out of it. And he sits down and watches the movie, all 5 hours and 20 minutes of it.
Yeah.
And he's just absolutely stunned. And I'm going to read a passage of the book.
Right.
It was an orgy of brilliant pictorial effects. And no one who sat in the theater would ever again question where the money had gone. For it was there to see. The sweep of movement before the camera. By the camera. Spectacular effect following spectacular effect until there couldn't be any more. But there were more. And still more after that. But little by little, the anxiety of anticipation gave way to satiety. And then to a sense of claustrophobia induced by the inundation of image and effect. We became disoriented, victims of sensory overload. deafening by undifferentiated soundtracks, the jingles of bridles, squeaks of boots, thwacks of hatchets in flesh, foreign tongues and accents all talking at once, or more, all singing at once. And still there was more. The battle, the pandemonium, the chaos, the terrorized animals, the blood, the debris, the explosives were relentless and the brain numbed, waiting for the last moaning immigrant to fall in the swirling dust, for the last brutal death to be done, for the last wave of picturesque fuller earth to blow across the last unblinking lens. And when the last fading image, as exquisite as the first, ran through the projector, I felt bludgeoned by vainglory and excess, surfeited by style, sound, and fury, my own. So in any case, it's a great book on old Hollywood, as I guess we'll now, know it as, because it's about the heyday of the great creative period of the 70s and the last film that was allowed to really come out of that system, because after Heaven's Gate, the studios were going to lock down and they weren't going to give the director that type of creative freedom ever again. And, you know, I hope we can talk more about Michael Cimino in a future episode. I know we left him out of movie jail, and he's probably the king resident of movie jail. But I also will say he's one of the most talented that's in movie jail as well.
Yeah.
I mean, fault Heaven's Gate all you like, but the man is a master at his craft.
Right. Well, awesome. That's definitely one. And you know, I remember seeing it on your shelf when we were in school, and I swear I read half of it or something. And I know that I've seen the film, but it would probably be a brand new film to me because it's been so long since I've seen it. So I definitely plan on digging that old one back up.
I was going to say, the nice thing is last year, I can't remember the name of the cable channel, but they did a 1-hour documentary on Final Cut interviewing all the principals.
Oh, cool.
That were involved. And it was a great special. I had it sent to me, and it was great just to hear, from Jeff Bridges, who, I don't know if people know this, but got to play one of his great-great-grandfathers in the film.
Oh, that's great.
One of his own ancestors named Bridges.
Wow.
Who actually, cool. Did own a bar, So I thought that was kind of a nice little touch.
That's very cool.
But, Final Cut, Stephen Bach. You should be able to easily find it in paperback and pretty cheaply as well.
All right, well, I'm going to do something a little more contemporary now, and this is not without controversy for me. I'll get into that a little bit, but really great book, loved it. It's called Rebel Without a Crew, or How a 23-Year-Old Filmmaker with $7,000 Became a Hollywood Player. And we all know him, Robert Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. He directed and this is really the making of El Mariachi is what it is. And really, really great book. I loved it from cover to cover. And he's a really good writer. I mean, he really went through and detailed really closely the making of this film. And I guess to me, I definitely have much respect for him for, his ability to get in there and make something happen. He got his film made. He didn't have a lot of money. He used his resources very well. And it's a great book for anyone who wants to be a filmmaker. I mean, this is a must read. And I appreciate and respect Rodriguez. I don't always love his work, but that's just my taste. You know what I mean? I know a lot of people, throw fits and think he's, the next coming of Peckinpah or something. But, I don't think that. But, like I said, I definitely respect him. And I liked some of his films. Spy Kids 1 was great. And I definitely loved El Mariachi also. I was able to pick up that nice double disc, the El Mariachi Desperado disc, mm-hmm. which I don't even know if is available anymore. And he really does a good job on his DVDs also. He has that little 10-minute film school that he does.
Yeah.
And he's got great commentaries. He talks from wall to wall. And I think, one of his missions in life as a filmmaker is to share with people about, how he did this stuff. And it's very evident in this book. And, and like I said, on his DVDs, he wants people to know you can do this. This is not beyond, the average person to at least get out there. I mean, he's talented. But, he's saying that, if you want it, you can make it happen. And, we've said that to a certain extent, but he's proved it.
Well, this is one of the qualities I most like about Rodriguez, because like you, I don't have to love all of his films.
Sure.
But I love the communal spirit that he has about filmmaking, and yeah. I think all filmmakers should share this.
Right.
And, you know, his story is a great one of inspiration. You don't even have to like El Mariachi, but you can really appreciate, you know, what he went through to get the film made.
Right.
I mean, it's any filmmaker I meet, you know, and just the fact that they finished the film, I already like it just because you got it made.
Right.
You know, I already respect the fact that you made the movie. You know, I mean, I don't have to love your movie, but, you know, the fact that you just got it completed, you know, says everything. I mean, that's a huge step. And a lot of times, though, the thing that drives the filmmaker at 2-3 in the morning that keeps him up late working on that screenplay or working on those, shot lists or staying up editing and sound mixing and all the other torturous things that you go through, you know, the sacrifices you make with family and friends and everything else. It's the inspiration that drives you. And it doesn't matter where you get it from, what movie
right.
you saw or what song right. you were listening to or what book you read. And a lot of inspiration that I know drives me and drives you and many other filmmakers out there come from books just like what Robert Rodriguez wrote.
Right.
And, you know, it's a great one to check out of the library. You should certainly read it before you go out and shoot your first feature film.
Oh, definitely.
It doesn't mean that it's going to be anything like El Mariachi. It's just, it's a good warm-up book of research.
Well, and if anything, it serves, like we said, as inspiration to say, you know what, use these resources, borrow the camera. You know, you don't have to have 500 tons and $100,000 worth of equipment to do things. Use what you have available. Make it work. You know, get a freaking wheelchair for your dolly shots.
Well, and he had it even tougher than anyone today had because he went out and did it on 16mm.
Right.
Which is just a step down from 35, which means you still got to have a lot of light. You know, you're still waiting probably on, 400-foot magazines
yeah.
at best that are noisy, so you're doing post-sync on everything. So he made it the hard way, you know. He shot the movie on short ends, I think.
Right.
So,
well, he definitely walked through fire to make El Mariachi happen. You know,
today's filmmakers, I think, have it a lot easier. The digital revolution, yeah. Just like the typewriter can make everyone a writer, yeah. The digital revolution can make everyone a filmmaker if they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. They're not all going to turn out to be Catcher in the Rye, you know, but there's going to be some interesting work. Good, bad, and ugly. But right. the tools are now there. So what makes you want to do it if the tools are there? It's the inspiration that's going to drive you. And hopefully this will give some to you.
Well, and in this book, I think another fascinating section in this book also is once the film is done, then, you know, that's the whole second step. You know, it's one thing to make a film, but then you got to get the film seen. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, this is a great story of, you know, going to Hollywood. You know, I mean, he was just trying to sell it to, you know, the Spanish channels,
mm-hmm.
you know, and make anything, you know, 10,000 or something. And he almost did it, you know, but at the last minute, you know, I think it was Columbia, went in there and said, you know, we're interested in this, hang on, you know. And it's a fascinating story, you know. He went out there and he made it happen, and he deserves what he got. I mean, you know, if anyone, he exemplifies, you know, putting your nose down to the grindstone and making it happen. And I respect the hell out of him.
A do-it-yourself attitude, because he yeah. is doing it himself.
He is.
You know, he's writing it, he's photographing it, he's editing it, directing it, doing the music. You know, I mean, I don't right. know how much he's doing on the special effects, but I'm sure he's got a hand in it, you know. So But that's the way I think films, well, it's not the only way to make films, but it seems the most practical way.
Right.
With today's technology, it enables you to do that. Because if you're going to be a filmmaker today, or if you're going to be a director, but a filmmaker, more importantly, you need to know how to do all those things as well or better, hopefully, than the people that you're going to hire to do those jobs for you.
Well, you got to be able to trust who you're going to hire, and, you know, you need to know something about that. But anyways, yeah, great book, Rebel Without a Crew by Robert Rodriguez. Definitely pick that one up. What you got?
All righty. Well, since we're kind of staying in on the independent filmmaker 90s thing,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to recommend a book by John Pearson called Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes. A guided tour across a decade of American independent cinema.
Cool.
I don't think you've read this one, have
I have
you?
Not read this one.
It's a good one. I should send this one
send
to
it,
you.
Send it.
Basically, like the title suggests, John Pearson has been a fixture in independent cinema, has helped get a lot of films financed and distributed, notably Spike Lee's first movie, She's Gotta Have It, hence the Spike, Michael Moore's Roger and Me, Richard Linklater's Slacker, and the sort of the wave of lesbian films that were sort of popping up in the mid-90s.
High like, art.
Yeah, Go Fish. However, for Kevin Smith fans out there, there's also chapters on Kevin Smith and Clerks, and also Kevin Smith interviews John Pearson throughout the book. So occasionally a chapter will come up and it'll be a new interview and it'll talk about, you know, he'll ask some really pointed questions. And Kevin Smith is, as anyone knows, is a great interview, you know,
right.
And an interviewee. So you're going to get both sides of that. You're also going to get sort of a trail through all the Sex Lies videotape and just how this early little movement was happening through the, you know, the Richard Linklaters and some of the ones that were off the beaten path. It does trace, you know, the early Tarantino through Miramax. And, it, you know, it traces, you know, through other films that he worked on, like, you know, The Thin Blue Line. And it's got a great chapter, which I think, again, anyone that wants to go out and be a director should read this chapter called Amongst Jerks. And it's about the making of a movie called Amongst Friends, written and directed by a young filmmaker named Rob Weiss. And it's sort of a textbook of everything you don't want to do in going out and how you treat other people and how you create relationships and basically how you promote yourself and your movie.
Right.
Not unlike that Troy Duffy story you saw very recently.
Great movie.
In the documentary.
Sadness. Sadness to have it all on a plate and then just to lose it all with your big, fat, stupid mouth. Sorry, Troy.
So anyway, in Spike Mike, Slackers and Dykes, if you're into independent cinema by any of the filmmakers that are mentioned, you certainly should get familiar with the name John Pearson, and it's a good read. And I mean, I picked up the book really cheap.
Cool, cool. Sounds great. Before there was Star Wars, there was Planet of the Apes. And I'm a big Apes fan. You know, I got the Evolution set, you know, all five films, plus the documentary. And it's called Planet of the Apes Revisited by Joe Russo, Larry Lanzman, and Edward Gross. And it's got a great foreword by Charlton Heston. But it's the behind-the-scenes story of a classic science fiction saga. And, you know, it really is a companion piece to that fantastic documentary that Roddy McDowell narrated called Behind the Planet of the Apes. This book is really a companion piece to that. I mean, it was written concurrently when that was being made, I think, that documentary. But it really traces the history of the Planet of the Apes series, you know, starting out with the Pierre Boulez novel, you know, and how that was translated for the screen. Completely different book. If you try to read it now, I mean, apes were, you know, in flying machines and helicopters and all that kind of stuff. It's a totally different thing. Obviously, it's the story, you know, of Arthur P. Jacobs, who really, you know, tried to make this thing happen. And they passed this script all around Hollywood, and it just got turned down and turned down and turned down. And it wasn't until Charlton Heston finally jumped on board that this thing happened. And, you know, it had a Rod Serling script. And that changed things up a lot. But it really is, you know, the whole genesis of how this ape things happened. And, you know, and of course, you know, the first film was a masterpiece, you know, and it's very well regarded. You know, you get into not only the story and the concept behind it, but also, you know, all the stuff with the makeup and how that came into being. And that's, you know, just an incredible thing because at the time, You know. Now it's all about, you know, effects and special effects. And when Star Wars came about, it was really about special effects. But back then, it was, you know, the big budget for that film was the makeup. I mean, that was the big effect. And so you get to see all that story. And it goes from, you know, one film to the next film to the next film to the next film. And you see kind of how the series eventually started falling apart. You know, because strangely enough, in today's world, and this is a flip thing, is that, you know, when a movie makes a lot of money and it's time for a sequel, today, usually that they spend more money on the sequel, you know. Mm-hmm. But back in those days, it was, you know, we're going to spend less on the sequel because, yeah, you know, we don't know if we can milk it anymore, you know. And they even went as far as to destroy the Earth in beneath the Planet of the Apes. And, you know, so they tried to kill it off. They said, you know, that's it. We're done. And but, you know, they said, no, we're going to keep it going. We want more. Eventually, they got up to 5 films. And, you know, the 5th film, as we all know, was just, a joke. Just not good. And the budget was so low. I think it was $1.5 million. But something to that effect. But really, we see the whole progression of the entire Ape story. They talk about the TV series. There was an animated series. It really is the A to Z on the Planet of the Apes saga and everything involved, the marketing and all that kind of stuff. And it really was the pre-launch, because you have a lot of people who were in love with Planet of the Apes, and, you know, the next big thing was Star Wars right after that. So Planet of the Apes Revisited, definitely worth your time to pick it up. If you're a Planet of the Apes fan, check it out.
Okay, I think moving from Planet of the Apes, I'm going to move over to the screenwriter side and mention 2 books that I found to be really entertaining reads, whether or not, you know, you were interested in screenwriting at all or just in Hollywood. But William Goldman has written 2 books, one called Adventures in the Screen Trade, and that, I believe, came out in 1984. He wrote a sequel book, and it was called Which Lie Did I Tell? And I believe that came out in 2001.
Yeah.
So anyway, basically, William Goldman is the guy who came up with one of the more famous phrases in Hollywood, is nobody knows anything. And, you know, as the writer of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and Misery and many others, Princess Bride, including, novelist, screenwriter, and also just an all-around Hollywood insider, you know, has been around 30, 40 years. Long enough to be hot, to be cold, to be hot again, and now to be cold again, you know? Mm-hmm. He's had a career that's certainly moved in different kind of waves. His insights in both of these books are invaluable. Now, just don't think because it was written in 84 that what he talks about doesn't apply today, mm-hmm. because that's not the case at all. Certain things don't really change in Hollywood. A lot of things are different, but most a lot of the things are exactly the same. And, you know, he has a lot of different anecdotes talking about, you know, a lot of his own screenplays and the process that he went through writing them. And he's very humble. He talks about, you know, his love of, you know, he wanted to write a love story about 2 of his favorite things, you know, traveling and wine. And, you know, came up with Year of the Comet, and it was an enormous flop. And he's got a great chapter on, you know, the writing of the movie and the making of it. And he's got a really funny anecdote where he remembers calling his daughter after it came out, and even his daughter hadn't gotten around to seeing it, you know. And he says, that's when you know you really have a flop, is when your own kids don't go see your work.
But that was one of those ones that we saw on Showtime in the middle of the afternoon, you know.
Right.
I mean, probably saw it, you know, 10 times. It's one of those,
you know,
cable
had Steve
classics.
McQueen and Ally McGraw been in it. Who knows?
Exactly.
You know?
A little bit different.
But in any case, he's a very entertaining writer, and he's got a great little passage here about another infamous writer on screenplay books, Robert McKee. And it goes something like this. McKee, can you learn how to write movies? No easy answer, but I would say if you have zero facility for the form, no. If you have some, writing courses can sure help a lot. At the very least, you will not write something like this, which I recently had to wade through. Names changed to protect the innocent. And he goes on to give a demonstration of something that someone gave him. It goes like this. Open up on a hill in a castle. Medieval times, footsteps are heard. King, where are my troops? Prime Minister, mounting up, sire. Cries are heard from somewhere. Prime Minister to a guard. See what that was. The guard departs. King, I did not like that sound. Back to Goldman. I think I made it to the top of page 4 before surrendering. When I pick up something like that, I feel sadness. Someone spent months on it. Someone has dreams of how the manuscript will change his life. Personally, I must have had considerable facility for the form. I never saw a screenplay until I was 33, and when I did, wrote one that got me fired, Charlie. But my second screenplay, Harper, was a hit and is still shown today. Butch Cassidy came two screenplays later.
That's a classic. Yeah.
So, in any case, you know, there's also a little great chapters at the end of Which Lie Did I Tell, where he gathers together several writers, including the Farrelly brothers, he gives them an idea and lets each one of them riff on the pitch and come up with different variations of a story.
Wow.
To see how the same story can go in different directions based on the writer that's involved, which is a great exercise, actually, just in starting to wrap your brain around constructing a screenplay around a story.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, William Goldman has written some great films, and he's written some, you know, so-so films, but he does understand the structure of movies, and you can certainly learn a lot from him. And, like I said earlier, he's very entertaining and a lot of fun to read.
Well, Adventures in the Screen Trade, I know, is one of those books. It's just, you know, it's like a given. You always pick it up. I mean, I remember it just being, you know, one of those things that was required of you if you had any interest in getting into Hollywood. I mean, it was, you know, pretty much common knowledge. And, yeah, I've read it. It's a great book. And I think, isn't the full screenplay for Butch and Sundance in there?
It is.
Yeah. So, which is another benefit of getting that book. And that's another thing. You know, that's a whole other form of books that, you know, they sell, is the whole, you know, book, screenplay within a book. You know, sometimes it's just, you know, a screenplay. You know, and I'm not really one that buys a lot of screenplays. I figure if it's on the screen, it's there. It is an interesting investigation. You're a writer.
I'm completely. I don't agree with that.
Well, I know that's fine, and I know that you're a writer. And
only
and,
because when you read the screenplays, you see how different they are from what actually ended up on the screen. Sometimes better, sometimes not.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to realize what went into the process, either through improvisation or direction, or, you know, even scoring.
Right.
That, you know, turned it into the film. I like the blueprint. I like to, if I really like a movie, I like to backwards deconstruct it.
Right.
And when I read the script, I can see what they had to work with and try and picture how they put the film together in each department.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's like code breaking. If you want to know how it was done, you just got to work your way backwards.
And that's cool. And I know that some people love to do that. I'm just not one of the ones who likes to do that. But, yeah, I mean, that's going all
now,
the way.
I'm not a big fan of the transcript. Sometimes you buy a screenplay and it's just a transcript.
That's really what I mean. You know what I'm
saying? I don't read those. It has to be the screenplay that was on the set in the screenplay form that they were actually working from.
Right,
I don't like the transcript versions of screenplays.
Yeah.
That just, you know, are transcribing what was on the screen.
What was exactly on the screen, yeah. And, yeah, those, yeah, they have a lot of those. But a lot of times, like, and this might be a book you were about to bring up, but a book, you know, that I read a long time ago was the, you know, Soderbergh did his Sex, Lies, and Videotape book,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, had the screenplay in there, but it also talked about the making of that film.
And he actually prefaces it with a chapter on some early scenes that were the first ones that he wrote, you know, during the development of the movie. I mean, he's got a great note, I remember, in that book of, you know, what was the kernel idea that he had, you know, what sparked it all. And it goes, idea number 7 from 1986 notebook, a film about deception and lost earrings. Item number 38 from 1986 notebook, everybody has a past. Item number 48 from 1986 notebook, friend on the couch, affair with the wife.
Oh.
And from those three things, he wrote a movie called Sexualized Videotape. And it does trace the pre-production, the full development of the screenplay, all of the production that he went through, post-production, and also how the film was received at Cannes, and just basically his whirlwind experience in making it. There's some great, great passages in there where he, you know, he's just even talking about the different films he was seeing during that time period, you know, going to the movies and what was inspiring him. And often he'll put his top 10 lists, you know, scattered throughout the book. you know, at any given time, and they change, you know, from like year to year. You know, his top tens are constantly evolving.
And I remember that. That was a fun thing about it, is that, you know, I always remember watching Raiders of the Lost Ark going up and down the list, up and down the list.
Right. I mean, 1 January '88, 10 favorites as of today. All the President's Men, Annie Hall, Citizen Kane, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, The Godfather, Parts 1 and 2, A Hard Day's Night, Jaws, Sunset Boulevard, The Third Man, 1,000 Clowns.
Oh, I thought Raiders was on there.
It's on another one.
Okay.
He changes his mind like a few months later, yeah, and I think Raiders gets on there.
5,000 Fingers of
Dr. T. I think it's great when
Dr.
you think about all those titles.
Yeah.
They really make up everything Soderbergh is,
yeah,
in many ways. It's interesting how even back in 88, you know, his blueprint was pretty much, you know, there, installed. But he always had one passage in here that has stuck with me always, and I'll end on this. For those aspiring to a career in the film business, I offer this equation. Talent plus perseverance equals luck. Be ready when it happens.
Right.
And that's always what I thought was, you know, probably the best advice that you could give to anybody. And, heck, I was glad to get it from him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that he's been an inspiration for both of us. He's a great, he's great. I mean, what can you say? But, yeah, and that's another great book. And I think the thing that's interesting about that is you don't only learn about the making of the film, but you learn about the making of the filmmaker. You know what I mean? It's a personal. It's these are pseudo biographies as well. You know, that's another.
Well, it is a diary book. I mean, he does give the diary format of the production of the movie.
Right.
So, but he's also giving a diary of himself. He's very revealing,
right,
in the book. But that's what, you know, makes it a really good read.
Right. So yeah, definitely great book. And
you know, I like to also segue into another book Steven Soderbergh wrote, and he wrote it at a very pivotal time in his career, pre Out of Sight, when he had done The Underneath, and he was very disappointed, and he went back and made Schizopolis in the same way that he made his early experimental films, and he wrote this book called Getting Away with It, or The Further Adventures of the Luckiest Bastard You Ever Saw. And it says, starring Steven Soderbergh, also starring Richard Lester as the man who knew more than he was asked. And the book has a twofold. It's basically a diary of what Soderbergh was going through his own sort of creative frustration with Hollywood and his own creative reinvention. At the same time, he's interviewing Richard Lester throughout the entire book about his entire career and the types of films he was making, because Soderbergh certainly can relate to a lot of Lester's style of filmmaking. He does list A Hard Day's Night, but also The Knack or How to Get It. You know, certainly the way Lester was pushing the medium at that time, with very creative, inventive filmmaking. But it's a great book. I mean, you'll learn a lot about Richard Lester, a filmmaker that you might not hardly know anything about. And it's also a great diary book on Soderbergh. Okay, here you go. Friday, 31 January 1997, Los Angeles. As far as Out of Sight goes, I am now competing against Cameron Crowe and Mike Newell. Crowe, coming right off Jerry Maguire and a DGA nomination, is obviously as cold as a blowtorch, and I don't have a chance if he says yes. Newell, I'm less concerned about, only because he just did a movie with criminals, and I think we'll turn it down. Casey Silver and Mark Platt are trying to get me to see Jersey Films and then Clooney, and I'm waiting by the phone. Then he's got another, you know, I think entry, which was it, like a couple of days later. Friday, 7 February 1997, Los Angeles. Cameron Crowe passed on Out of Sight. Mike Newell said it was too much like Donnie Brasco, the film he just finished. And so today I met with Danny DeVito, Stacey Shearer, Michael Schamburg, and George Clooney. By my standards, the meeting went well. I had done my homework and tried to explain in clear terms how I saw the film. Word got back that they felt the meeting went well, but Casey told me that they are going to meet with Ted Dim tomorrow and that Sidney Pollack will be giving a read this weekend.
Oh, my God.
But in any case, I'm not really touching on the Richard Lester stuff, which is absolute gold. Right. It's a really fun book, and for any fan of Steven Soderbergh out there, I certainly recommend it and seek it out.
All right, well, let me flash over to another one here, and this is another fanboy. I guess I'm the fanboy kid today, but this is a classic when it comes to making of books, and it's called The Jaws Log, and it's written by Carl Gottlieb. And Carl was actually with Peter Benchley, wrote the screenplay for Jaws. And it really, it's your basic, you know, going through the story of making this film, you know. And, you know, back in 75, when this film started to get made, you know, it wasn't like this was Spielberg that we're talking about. You know, I mean, this sure, this was Spielberg, but this was young Spielberg. This was Spielberg who, you know, came off a modest hit, you know, Sugarland Express. And he had not made his name yet. And so, you know, they were taking a shot at this. And so this is really the story of a young filmmaker, you know, who obviously would become, you know, the biggest filmmaker. And how he made his first big monster hit. And, you know, it was a monster hit because it was a monster movie. And but you get to see all the story, you know, and you know, I think the one thing that, you know, everyone always takes away is that this was the seminal movie about how to not shoot on the water. You know what I mean? It was the movie where you learned, you know, if you're going to shoot on the water, you know, let's shoot in the tank on the studio set or lot or something like that. But for the love of God, we're not going to go out into the ocean. But really, this is a classic book. And I know that they've, and I didn't even know this until tonight when I went on Amazon and looked. And, you know, they've been putting out new editions to this book for a long time. They, you know, just like they're doing the DVD. So it's, I guess it's, you know, book ripoff or something.
Well, hey, no. On that one, I'll give a pass because there's a time where you couldn't find Jaws Log.
Oh, really?
You know,
okay.
It was out of, or, you know, I mean, it can be, it could have been a tough book to find. So right. I don't mind reissues of a good, you know, book sure. that, you know, is out of print.
Well, I still have my nasty little, you know, paperback, you know, small paperback, you know, original version of this thing from the mm-hmm. 70s. And I mean, I'm glad to have the classic version, but yeah, there was a nice new trade paperback, you know, 30th anniversary edition. But, I mean, really, it really is, like I said, just the basic story. They talk about, you know, the shark that Spielberg named it Bruce and that it never worked. I mean, this whole book is about the mechanical failures of this movie, but in the end, it really made Spielberg have to really figure a way out of it because it couldn't just be, you know, a jump and scare. He had to make it work with less and make it work without the monster. And in the end, everyone praised him and said, you know, that they made you imagine it worse because you didn't mm-hmm. actually get to see it much. Well, a lot of the reason you didn't get to see Bruce more was because he was broken all the damn time.
Well, and the other sort of ancillary effect that happened was because they had so much downtime of the shark, they really had a lot of time to work on the characters and characterizations, and it became really strong between the three leads.
Right.
And I think that helped out a great deal in making the movie what it is because, I mean, we always remember the shark, but it's the characters that really drive that movie.
Well,
that
exactly.
really engage us. And all three actors, you know, they were stuck there on that island, you know. They were stuck there like their character.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think it shows in the subtlest of ways in the movie. It's just great.
Well, and the book even goes into those details about, you know, times like, you know, when that, you know, the, you know, Quint's big speech when he talks about, you know, what happened during World War II and, you know, when his ship went down, the waters,
right.
Yeah, the waters were full of sharks, you know, how, you know, they couldn't quite make that work. And in the end, they really, you know, they all kind of got drunk and Robert Shaw just pulled that out of some, you know, a story that he knew. It wasn't, you know, scripted or anything.
Actually, there's different versions of that particular story.
Okay.
And from what I remember is, and they do talk about it in that documentary, because it's like the great Rashomon speech, you know.
Right.
Everyone's got a different version of how it goes. But Spielberg says, you know, the version is, you know, each writer took a pass at it,
right.
You know, and even Spielberg took a pass. But then what it came down to is Robert Shaw taking the whole story and then spitting out his version of it.
Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark, he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eye. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you, and those black eyes roll over white, and then, oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red and In spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces.
And it's such a great scene. I mean, it really is that character. It marks that character of Quint. And
I think even old John Milius did a pass on that, just to bring Milius back in.
Oh, he would be perfect for that part.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I think his fingerprints are in there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds something like Milius would write. So, but yeah, so like I said, really, I mean, it's A to Z. I mean, you know, a lot of people have seen Jaws. They've seen the making ofs. And it's just getting deeper into it. And it's a great book. Definitely worth your time. And you can probably find it for pretty cheap. So that's another great one. But
yeah, I mean, I guess in today's age of full-on media making of mm-hmm. movies, you know, we've replaced reading quotes by just watching the actor say them, you know,
right.
in the interviews.
Right.
But, you know, often the quotes, like in a novel, you know, it can be a lot richer in the reading experience. You're going to get things that you don't get in a typical, you know, documentary.
Right.
Okay, the next series that I want to talk about, and I did use the word series because it just won't be one book, but I'll start off with the first book, will be Cassavetes on Cassavetes. And this is a famous series of books that have been, I believe, Faber, which is a company out of England, has been putting out for many, many years.
Right, yeah.
I call it the On series.
Yeah, I've got a few of them.
Of books. And many filmmakers are certainly profiled, including Woody Allen, Terry Gilliam, David Cronenberg, David Lynch, Alfred Hitchcock, John Sayles, Martin Scorsese, Krzysztof Kieslowski, Tim Burton, Barry Levinson, Paul Schrader. All of them have On books. And I believe A Man on Man is due to come out this year.
Uh-oh, I wonder who'll be buying that one.
But the reason I mentioned Cassavetes on Cassavetes, because, I mean, I think, frankly, and I am speaking to the filmmakers out there, he is one to look to.
Mm.
He is the man that picked up a camera, you know, and went out and made the movie himself. You know, like before Rodriguez, you know, Cassavetes was doing that at a time period when not a lot of people, especially actors that could actually make money from acting, were not putting their own money into their own little productions.
Yeah.
I mean, Cassavetes was often accused of making these little home movies, but they are quite original and revealing, and quite frankly, a lot of his films are hard to watch, but not because they're not great. It's just because they're so intimate. You start to feel like a voyeur. You start to feel uncomfortable watching his films.
Yeah.
And I don't get that experience very often. And I when I come across a filmmaker like that, that makes me feel that way, you know, my first reaction would be is just to kind of shy away and not, you know, why do I want to, you know, be manipulated like that or have my feelings or a movie bring that out. But then when you go the other way and you start, you know, getting into the process behind it, you start discovering a lot more, not only about yourself, but about, you know, the possibilities of film and filmmaking. And what kind of stories you can tell on film. And Ray Carney, who is, you know, one of the prominent experts on John Cassavetes, was responsible for this particular book. It's 500 pages. It's all conversations with Cassavetes. And all of these books they're just straight interviews with the directors.
Right.
Which I prefer 100% over any biography.
Right,
on a director.
Right.
I'd just rather have their long, long, long quotes. And Cassavetes rambles on sometimes for pages. But Carney knows what questions to ask. And this is, you know, a book that, you know, only came out, you know, a few years ago, but was certainly 20 years in the research and the making before it did come out.
Give me some titles of Cassavetes films.
Shadows, Faces, A Woman Under the Influence, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, Opening Night, Gloria, Love Streams.
Okay.
I mean, these were the, you know.
He's a filmmaker I have yet to really investigate. I think I've seen A Woman Under the Influence. I don't remember. It was in college.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be a great masterclass future subject someday.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's a quote that I really liked in the book, and I'm just kind of one of many, but he says along the lines of, "The things we got praise for were things we tried to cure. All those things were accidents, not strokes of genius. We didn't have any equipment. We didn't have a dolly. And we had all this movement, so we used long lenses. and we were photographing in the street because we couldn't afford a studio or couldn't afford even to go inside someplace, yeah. you know. And our sound, when we opened Shadows in England, they said, the truest sound that we've ever seen. Well, at that time, almost all the pictures, certainly all the pictures at 20th Century Fox were looped. You know, all the sync that all the actors actually spoke on the stage was cleaned up and made to be absolutely sterile so that there was no sound behind anything. If you saw traffic, you wouldn't hear it. You'd just hear voices so that the dialogue would be clean. But we recorded most of Shadows in a dance studio with Bob Fosse and his group dancing above our heads, and we were shooting this movie. So I never considered the sound. We didn't even have enough money to print it to hear how bad it was. So when we came out, we had Sinatra singing upstairs and all kinds of boom, dancing feet above us. And that was the sound of the picture. So we spent hours, days, weeks, months, years trying to straighten out this sound. Finally, it was impossible. And we just went with it. Well, when the picture opened in London, they said, this is an innovation, you know? Innovation? We killed ourselves to try to ruin that innovation.
That's awesome.
So, seek out Cassavetes.
Yeah, really, that sounds great.
He's not going to entertain you, but he's going to show you possibilities of film that are not common.
Yeah.
He's an original, certainly, and uncompromising every step of the way. His pictures are long. You know, sometimes 2.5 hours and talky, real talky.
Yeah.
They're behavior pictures, but they're as authentic as anything you're likely to see.
Cool. Well, I read the Levinson on Levinson. That's one that I owned for a while. I know that I've read some more. I think Scorsese, but,
And they keep updating Scorsese's, which is nice.
That's great.
You know,
right.
It is updated, I think, even to include The Aviator now.
Wow.
I mean, I've bought it twice because it's been updated.
Wow.
But, you know, I've read them all. And, you know, certainly I can reread them over and over again. I mean, just sometimes getting the Kieslowski quotes or the Gilliam quotes or, you know, even someone like, you know, David Lynch and Woody Allen. Mm. And especially John Sayles, you mm-hmm. know. Because, you know, Sayles has always been an important, you know, influence for me, you know, just in terms of, you know, the independent writer-director that's making his picture.
Right.
And the last book, well, that I wanted to make sure I read is probably the most important book that I can recommend out of all of these. And it has nothing to do with making movies, but it has everything to do with if you want to make movies in Hollywood. And it's called The Hollywood Rules: What You Must Know to Make It in the Film Industry. And it's written by Anonymous.
Ooh.
And it's subtitled The Book Hollywood Doesn't Want You to Read. And basically the authors are certainly respected within the Hollywood establishment. They know all of the ins and outs of how the town works. But they certainly did want to go on record for revealing a lot of this information.
All right.
I'm just going to talk about some of the table of contents and let you sort of fill in the blanks. I mean, a lot of it is etiquette. A lot of it is the kind of things that you should know. And if you don't know, you need to know. And even if you already know, it's certainly good to refresh yourself and to remind yourself and to prepare yourself.
Right.
I mean, the foreword is titled Hollywood's Best Kept Secrets. And then chapter one is all about laying the foundation. I mean, and they make it really clear. You want to work in Hollywood. You live in Hollywood.
That's for sure.
That's step one.
Don't even try it, folks.
You
will lose.
If you can't do that one, then you don't even continue on.
You will lose.
Chapter two covers the Hollywood rules. And rule number one, like I said, get local.
No, that's not right. Rule number one, don't talk about Hollywood. All right, sorry.
But rule number two, give them what they want. Never second guess the market. Remember, everything old is new again. Pay attention to detail. Read everything. Be a professional, or at least look like one. Don't go it alone. Make the right friends. Keep in touch. Don't be a pest. Always end the phone conversation first. Don't date anyone in the industry unless... ... Make the most of Hollywood parties. Know how to work a restaurant. Always take the meeting. Accept the beverage. Probably the most important chapter.
Of course.
If you want the job, you'll accept the beverage.
The mineral water.
Know when to show up and when to shut up. Always have a project in hand. Learn to love rejection.
Ooh, yes.
Let me repeat rule number 20. Learn to love rejection.
Zing.
Rule 21, ask for everything. Get it in writing. create a paper trail, be easy to work with, how to take a plunger up the ass, and other ways to deal with getting screwed. That's a chapter. Rule number 25, you'll probably need to read that one more than once. Rule 26, share the credit. 27, take the money and don't walk, run. Rule 28, pace yourself. 29, keep the karma gods happy. And rule number 30, don't share the Hollywood rules. I discovered the book by just doing a little research online for something else, and it just kind of came up in recommended books. And it was cheap, so I just decided to pick it up as a used book. And it's quite a good read. And it's the book that I would want to hand anybody going to LA and wanting to make a career out of it, no matter how talented or untalented they are, how big their dream or how small their dream.
Right.
No matter if they have a little passion or a lot of passion, or they just want to work, or they just want to meet people, or they want to go starstruck or whatever.
What? Beep.
Whatever.
But knowing the Hollywood rules is certainly going to play a lot in your success. And, I mean, the key thing is, you know, everything you say can and will probably come back to haunt you, especially in today's internet age. You know, it's not like the old days where you might have dropped a quote in a magazine and it might even taken a month before anyone to find out about that quote. Those days are gone.
Well, are you cautious in the Hollywood Saloon?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just trying to speak the truth. Yeah. I'm not out to really slam anybody.
No.
If I'm asked to give critique on a film or a situation, I'm just going to give an honest assessment of it.
Yeah.
You know, and no matter what the director, I can find positive and negative critiques, I'm sure, unless you're Stanley Kubrick or something.
You're too nice to Ratner.
But, you know, I try to be objective, and, you know, I don't think I would treat anyone that we talk about in the Saloon, hopefully not any differently than I'd treat any of my other creative artist friends.
Sure. Oh, you mean you would treat U-Bull okay?
I haven't seen U-Bull.
I bowl okay. I mean, you know.
I mean, is U-Bull a shooter? Can he at least shoot and cut pretty well? I don't know.
I don't know. He's the new
I don't know anything
boy.
About him, but, you know, I mean, he's got I tell you one thing, yeah, I could have a conversation with U-Bull. I want to know how he gets so much freaking work.
Yeah.
He's got 7 films lined up.
Yeah. Well, they're all video games, so.
Who cares? He's working. He's doing something. He figured something out in the system.
Yeah.
That guy writes a book? Yeah, I might want to read it. We could learn something, you know. You can learn something from the Brett Ratners and the Paul W. Andersons and all these other guys. I mean, you don't have to like their movies. It's not about that. But they have found a way to circumvent the system, and they're working. Yeah. And you need to ask yourself, what are they doing that you're not that allows them to work?
Anyways, I'm going to wrap up my book selections here with a couple books that are kind of in tandem here. And first of all, I'd like to say that one of my not only favorite making of documentary / films of all time, but one of my favorite movies of all time would probably be Hearts of Darkness. And that's a film that was the making of Apocalypse Now. And, you know, you've heard me talk and say that Apocalypse Now is one of my most favorite films of all time. And wow, that documentary is absolutely brilliant. And I couldn't recommend any film more than that when it comes to behind the scenes making of and what it takes to make a film. And it really, I mean, it just shows to me the light of who Francis Coppola is and the brilliance and genius that he is and what he went through and suffered through to make that film happen. But anyways, along the way in that journey, that, what was it, 5-7 years in the making or something, his wife Eleanor wrote a book, and it was called Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now. And it was much like that Soderbergh diary. It was kind of a diary, and she goes through, and she just really explains, you know, this is what happened today. Today there was a hurricane or a, you know, whatever came through, a storm came through, and, you know, wiped out all of our sets and all that kind of stuff. And it really just gets down in there, and it's a great, like I said, it's another companion piece, really, to this film, because actually in the film a lot of the her VO, her voiceover, is taken directly from this book. And so it's just another way that you can read what was going on there. And if you really like to get into that film, you have that there. And it's nice because it's coming straight from his wife. You know, this isn't someone else they hired. You know, this is someone who's directly involved. I mean, and they had their kids there, you know, on the set and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, you really get to dig in there and see how deep that goes. And the other book, you know, is also a part of that. And it's the book that I started reading in the very beginning of the show. And it's called The Apocalypse Now book by Peter Cowie. And again, it's, you know, on the front it says, The Making of Francis Ford Coppola's Epic Based on Unprecedented Access to His Private Archives. And it really is, you know, pretty much the same thing. It's not in diary form. It really just goes through and chronicles the making of the whole film, you know, from the beginning to the process to, you know, the endless hours spent dealing with Marlon Brando. And that whole process. And there's even a chapter, and we had just talked about this the other day. You said, had I seen the 5.5-hour version?
Yeah, the work print.
Right, and they have a big section all about that in this book, too. So, anyways, it's, you know, and it just follows the whole Jaws log thing. And these are really my favorite kind of film books. It's really just, you know, one film, and we're going to get down as deep and dirty into this film as we possibly can. And that's what this book is. And it's a nice book. It's got tons of pictures, whereas the Eleanor Coppola's book, you know, wasn't really filled with a lot of pictures. But, you know, that would be a really good tag team if you could pick up both those books at the same time. If you like Apocalypse Now, you know, get your redo, get these books, really get down in there and see how a masterpiece came together. So, two great books. And let's do something we haven't done in a while. Let's do something fun. And we talked about this before we decided to do it. So if we're going to do a show on books, let's give a book away. You know?
Okay.
We tried to do this before with our saloon swag and it bombed because I think our... I think our trivia question was a little too hard at the time and no one knew who the hell Kieslowski was because we said, you know, go to our front page and tell us who our directors are and everyone's like, who's that guy? So that didn't work, and so we didn't have any takers on that, but that's okay. But I want to give you the Apocalypse Now book. We got an extra copy here, and tell you what, we're going to do a little saloon swag. And we talked before, what can we do? Well, we're going to do something decent, you know, not too hard. So what you need to tell me, and this is the trivia question, so get your hand on your button, and here's what it is. In the film, you will see a famous director make a cameo in the film, and he's actually shooting a war documentary at the time.
Keep going. Don't look in the camera. Don't look in the camera. Just go by like you're fighting. Like you're fighting. Don't look at the camera. It's for television. Just go through. Go through. Just go by. Keep going.
Who is that director? So, tell you what. First person who sends me an email with the correct name of that director, you got the Apocalypse Now book.
Woohoo!
All right. So, get to work. And let's see, you know, how long it takes. And, you know, it's fair game for everybody because we're going to put it out on the feed. And we'll put a post up on the website or in the forums probably when it's done. And, you know, don't bother sending it anymore. But there you go. Free stuff from the saloon. So, anyways, enough of that. Let's do some quick gunshots here now because what we're going to do is run through a couple more books because we just love to tell you more and more and more about books.
Well, a couple of honorable mentions here.
Yeah, honorable mentions. So show me, give me some honorable mentions.
Well, I don't know if the series is still going on, but John Borman was an editor for a book series in the 90s called Projections. Mm. And I got a few of them, up to about at least 5 or 6. And they range from essays and interviews and behind the scenes and just notes from all kinds of aspects of filmmaking, from directors and writers and cinematographers and production designers and composers.
Cool.
All about, you know, the process of making movies.
Yeah.
The first book had a Michael Mann interview in it. Hey. So, you know, it was a great introduction for me. I mean, profiles, you know, and interviews for everyone from Coen Brothers to Tarantino. I mean, all the way down the line, it's been an impressive series.
Cool.
And, you know, John Borman is certainly passionate about his subject. And it... You know, it's certainly you're going to learn about some eclectic you know, foreign film directors and films that you didn't know anything about. Oh. And that's what I always like, is the things you discover that, you know, wouldn't normally come across your path.
Cool.
Another one I can certainly recommend for anyone that's a fan of the filmmakers of the 70s in that time period, Peter Biskin wrote a book called Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. Now, I have to recommend this book with an asterisk because there's a lot of inaccuracies in it. And, I mean, I've read enough about each of these individual directors through several other biographies that when I read a a book that tries to gather together like this and find errors in it, I always got to question everything else that's in the book. Because even one error means that there could be a lot of others, if one's allowed to slip through. But, however, if you're interested in the wave of the movement of everything from Easy Rider to Peter Bogdanovich to Francis Ford Coppola to William Friedkin to Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Paul Schrader and John Milius and Martin Scorsese and Brian De Palma and just that whole movement that was coming out of the 70s, this chronicles all of those filmmakers. And Warren Beatty and a lot of the other sort of insider stories. And it's filled with a lot of gossip. In fact, sex, drugs, and rock and roll is the driving force of the book. I mean, if you want to know how much coke Martin Scorsese was doing, this is the book you read. But
wasn't there a film based on the book?
There was a documentary, Easy Riders and Raging Bull, that came out along with A Decade Under the Influence. Both of them are kind of covering the same, you know, issue. In fact, Dennis Hopper was quoted as saying there were so many inaccuracies in the book, he agreed to participate in the documentary to clear them up.
How funny.
Is Easy Riders, Raging Bulls an entertaining read? Hell yeah, it is, you know? Because I like all those directors. Yeah. And, you know, there's certainly going to be nuggets of truth inside the fiction. Right. So, yeah, I found an entertaining read, to be sure. The other one that is sort of similar is The Rebels on the Backlot by Sharon Waxman. I think it came out about a year ago.
Yeah.
And it tries to just center its focus on a few filmmakers in the 90s who have been able to sort of break through the system. It's subtitled Six Maverick Directors and How They Conquered the Hollywood System.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about, you know, Quentin Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson, Steven Soderbergh, and David O. Russell, David Fincher, Spike Jonze.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, its focus is a little bit smaller on just those individual filmmakers and how they broke in. There's also errors in that book as well, so you can read with caution. But there's some great quotes, and you know, we certainly reference it in our David Fincher Masterclass episode.
Right. Okay, great. Well, I got a couple of quick honorable mentions, too. I read a book quite a number of years ago called Fast Fade. It's called Fast Fade, David Putnam and Columbia Pictures and the Battle for Hollywood. And it really, David Putnam was a producer. He produced Midnight Express, Chariots of Fire, a few other things. And he became, after those successes, they asked him to become the head of Columbia. And so, you know, you get to see his rise and then his fall because, you know, he was out at Columbia after 1 year. So, you know, it's the typical story, the rise and then the fall of David Putnam. And it's fascinating. It's an interesting read. And so, you know, it's a little dated, obviously, because it's been a few years since, you know, those films have been out. But that's a good one. Another really good one is called The Devil's Candy, The Bonfire of the Vanities Goes to Hollywood by Julie Salomon. And, you know, this is really just the whole story behind Bonfire of the Vanities, movie that came out a few years ago, the Brian De Palma film. And I know you've read this one also, but yeah, it really just is this whole story, you know, the ups and downs, the making of a film, and, you know, all the mess that this film became.
A good companion piece to Final Cut, actually.
Really, really. Okay. Well, great.
As a book.
Great. So, yeah, that's another one. Another personal favorite of mine and was called Star Trek Movie Memories by William Shatner.
Shatner, right. It is good.
Yeah. Great book. It really just... and he had also made previously one just that was just called Star Trek Memories, where he talked about his time on the original series. But more for me, because I fell in love with the original Star Trek crew via the films. He goes, you know, through the whole story, film by film by film, and just laying out his memories and his experiences on those films. You know, he, you know, obviously mostly he centered a lot on episode 5, the one he directed, the worst one. But
but it's not his fault.
It's not my fault. They screwed me, man. They screwed me, man. But no, that's a fantastic book if you're a Trekkie. Definitely worth your time. You can find that anywhere because, you know, it's, you know, there's so many Star Trek books now. Last one I'll talk about is not really a book at all, but it's a magazine. But I think it's such a great high-end magazine that it really is a book. And you remember back when we were in school and I used to get Cinefex magazine.
Cinefex, right.
And really it is. I mean, I think it came out like quarterly. And and I would take them and put them in a big notebook. And they were fantastic. And if you wanted to know anything about special effects, I mean, you know, really behind-the-scenes gritty stuff, getting in there and working special effects, this was where you went. And it's real expensive. I mean, it's fairly expensive.
But they were extensive. I mean, right on down to the type of lighting and, you know, what kind of equipment they were using and how they pulled off the effect.
Right.
Which, you know, that was really one or two, three places that you could ever learn that kind of information.
Right. And it was really a new making of. And it would come, you know, in the mail and I'd open up that package and, oh, my God, it would be, you know, it would be like some new great sci-fi movie on the cover, and you'd be like, awesome. And you get this whole section, you know, all on Star Wars or all on
the
Tron.
Abyss.
The Abyss. Oh, when I got the Abyss one, I think the whole magazine was the Abyss.
It was the whole issue, yeah.
And it was like, awesome. I can't wait to get into this. And just incredible color photography in that thing. And, you know, and I checked on the internet, and they are still around, and they got a website, www.cinefex.com. Fantastic magazine. But like I said, really, it is a book, every issue you get. And that's why you pay so much for it, but worth the money.
I wanted to ask you about another book we've mentioned on an earlier show, but I know you're reading now, Joe Esterhaas's Hollywood Animal.
Yep, absolutely. I went to the library, picked it up, and I'm enjoying it thoroughly. He's hilarious. Mm-hmm.
I have to recommend that one, too, for listeners out there that didn't pick it up from the episode where we previously mentioned it.
Yep.
You can hate Joe Esterhaas and love this book.
Yeah.
You know, it's and especially if your interest is Hollywood, this is the Hollywood that you're not going to get on Entertainment Tonight.
That's for sure.
You know, this is the real Hollywood. So read it with caution.
Yeah.
For sure. But Esterhaas, first and foremost, is a great writer, and he knows how to entertain and entice and give the reader, you know, a full meal.
Right. And you've read, but I haven't read that, but it's on my, you know, to get soon list, was Julia Phillips' book, right?
Right. Yeah, You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again.
Right, which is another industry...
classic, you know, industry book.
Yeah.
You know, certainly. And then you can read the version with the call girls called You'll Never Make Love in This Town Again, where they expose all their star clients
that
they have on their rosters.
Oh,
also, Jim Hampshire wrote a great book on the making of Natural Born Killers.
Ooh, I want that.
That I can recommend for anyone that's a fan. Oh. It was called Killer Instinct. And, you know, that was basically one of her first films as a producer. And she talks about how she found the script through Quentin Tarantino, how she developed it and got Oliver Stone interested and basically got him, you know, on board, and the ride that she went through that is the making of an Oliver Stone movie. I mean, you want to know about how Oliver Stone and his process and what he goes through in making a movie? This is your book. Well, I know one of the most instrumental tools for me in training my own mind to think in pictures was, you know, if there was a movie that I couldn't see in the theater, you know, like Alien, that I couldn't get my parents to take me to see, I'd read the novelization first.
Right.
And then go see the movie.
Yeah,
you know, and sometimes maybe go back and reread the book after I'd seen the movie, or read a novelization after I'd already seen the movie.
Right.
But through that, just to read a novelization without seeing a movie, you almost get to make the movie in your own head.
That's true.
You get to picture it. You start developing, you know, if you can start thinking in shots and, you know, how things are laid out, you know, it can be a lot of fun to read a novelization because the movie's playing in your own head.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's a whole nother version of a film book, you know, is the whole novelization thing. You know, was it written before or was it written after? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how different is it? What extra scenes do you have? I know that I've enjoyed reading the Star Wars adaptations because there's extra stuff, especially in Revenge of the Sith, man. Oh, just a totally, you get so much more in the book.
And, you know, anyone that reads Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep knows that it's not the Blade Runner they know and love.
Not at all. Not at all. And it's always worth, if you like the film, to go and read the source material if it was not based on an original screenplay, because you can get a whole different thing. And that's very different and very cool at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But, you know, we really looked at it in this whole episode, movie books, and I think they are important to film lovers. I mean, and, you know, I know a lot of you guys probably agree with us, and you have your library, and we have our libraries, and I often go back to them.
Well, and it's a great gift a lot of these filmmakers are giving back to people like themselves that love movies. I mean, I remember, you know, Spike Lee, I think for his first five movies, wrote individual making of books for each one.
Got them at the library.
And She's Got a Habit book and The School Days and, you know, Do the Right Thing and Mo Better Blues.
Yeah.
I mean, these were very extensive diary books about every aspect of the production. You know, very personalized and filled with sort of Spike's, you know, wry humor.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember reading those and, you know, they were very influential. Because, you know, he was out doing it, you know, and he made the process, he simplified it enough to, you know, instill the idea that you could too.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's part of it. You know, I think, you know, that through the words of filmmakers, they're telling us that we can too. And part of that is reading these books. And so it's a great part of filmmaking, and it's available to everyone, so that's great. I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up and just say, hey, you know, we will have links to every book, if it's available, you know, out there on Amazon or somewhere else. I'll make a page that is specifically for the books and how you can get them. You know, and you might even try eBay, you know, or half.com.
I got a lot of these off of Amazon, so I know.
Yeah, and so and I've looked up most of them. I know they're available. So, you know, you're probably going to be able to find everything. So we hope it's meant something to you. Okay, going to go ahead and wrap up this episode. As always, you are always welcome to come by our website at www.hollywoodsaloon.com. Right now, like we've said earlier, you definitely want to come by and check out our new special edition page with, you know, new shows and new content on there that you can only get from direct download right from the website. As normal, you know, our Frapper map is up and doing great. I think we've got like, last I checked, like 84 folks. 23 new since the last time we tried. And like I said, if you join up on our Frapper map, we're going to give you quick shout outs. And we're going to do that. We got to do some catching up now since we haven't done a show in a while. And we've got 23 new people to hit here, so I'm going to go ahead and hit that now. I want to give a big hey out to John Callender out there. He has a message he wrote for us. Says, listening to the Hollywood Saloon during my mind-crushing three-hour commute to and from Santa Monica. It's actually someone who likes our shows being long. So thanks, John. We appreciate that. And John's got his own blog/podcast out there. It's at www.lies.com, LIES. And he does a lot of political discussion, things like that. And he talks a lot about movies, too, because he's a big movie fan. But that's a fun place to check out. Definitely going to give a big holler out to my... probably my best friend in the whole world, Richard Fernandez. And, I mean, me and Rich go way back. And I've actually mentioned him before, but he finally got on our map. He's in Flagstaff, Arizona. And he says, this place is ballistic. Keep up the good work. Here we go. Next is Nick Richardson. And he's in Sydney, Australia. And, I mean, Nick is awesome. He's emailed me a few times. We've talked back and forth. And just listen to what he says. This is probably my favorite quote I've ever gotten on the Frapper map, and he says, spank my ass and call me Wilma. Seriously, go ahead, everyone else does. If Hollywood Saloon doesn't rock my and whoever else's shoes that I happen to be in at the time, keep them coming, boys. So thanks, Nick. You're awesome, dude. I appreciate you listening. I hope you're still listening. We need to talk back on email again because it's been a while. Okay, Mike S. He is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And great. All you guys up north listening, that's fantastic. The closer to Canada. We got a lot of people listening in Canada. So that's awesome. We've got Angeline in Paris, France. Very cool. Great to hear from you all the way over there in France. I've got Christian Using Anderson. And he's from Denmark. And he says, your show is effing cool. Enough said. And I appreciate that, especially the effing. Number 7, we got Iconoclast. And that's Richard S. And he's in Calgary up there in Canada. And he's got one of my favorite blogs that I always go to. It's at www.insidetheidiotbox.com. Just, he does great lists and pictures, and it's just a really well-rounded blog. Video stuff, always entertaining. And he says, hey guys, great job on the show and the website. I kind of stumbled onto your site a couple of months back, and I've been telling everyone about it, and we appreciate that. And, you know, we added on our links page a thing for listener blogs. And if you've got a blog and you're a listener to the Hollywood Saloon, let me know, and we'll put a link right up to you on there. And we also put a new thing for listener production companies, because a lot of you guys out there are filmmakers yourself, and you've got a production company. And we'll list you on the site for fun if you want to be listed. So go check out our links website, our links page, and see if that's something you want to be interested in. Okay, moving forward here. Gary Ferguson is in Vancouver, and he says, great show. We listen to it while he's at work, and appreciate that. We've got a few people who do that, actually. So we're glad to be your help you get through the day there. Next person is Wesley. This is Wesley, my 9-year-old boy, and he has a great picture of SpongeBob in there, up there. And he says, have a spongy saloon. And so I love you, Wes, and thanks for listening and caring about the saloon. He's real excited that we do the Hollywood Saloon. And he always says, can I be on? Can I be on? And if you listen to the end of the Star Wars episode, you've heard it. All right, moving along. Jeremy Hinton from Sydney, Australia. And he says, love the show. Can you do a show on great Hollywood break-in stories? There are some great ones out there. And definitely, that's a great idea for a show. You know, we would just research it and pick out some great stories. And there's definitely some great stories out there. And he's got a nice picture of a kid on there. And I'm guessing that's his kid or that's him as a kid. But great shot there, too. We got Eric Fullerton in Huntsville, Alabama. And he says, I love the saloon. You guys are so easy to listen to. And you have really worthwhile opinions. Always looking forward to the next episode. And he's got a picture of himself up there. So, man, thanks, Eric. It's great to hear that you're enjoying the show. And you're actually in the United States. We got so many folks listening in Australia and Canada, and which is humbling. I mean, that's amazing. But great to hear from people in the United States, too. We have Jason Bovberg, or Booberg, Bovberg. My writing's bad. I apologize, Jason, from Fort Collins, Colorado. And he says, how about a show about Hitchcock? Well, yeah, that's true. And we eventually will get there, definitely. Great idea. You know, anyone you've heard of, we're usually going to get, unless we just hate them. But, and we definitely do not hate Hitchcock. Moving along, we got Kirk Whiten from Fort Collins, Colorado, and I guess that's a friend of Jason's. Thanks for listening. Maybe not, but they're both from Fort Collins, so that's cool. Big shout out to Fort Collins then. Tim May in Erie, Pennsylvania. And Tim's, he joined up our site. He's got a blog / podcast thing going on of his own called Laser Bolts from the Corner. And just go to our links and to the blog section, and you can link to that there. But he says, great podcast. I listen to it whenever it comes out. And he's been real active on our forums, too. So we appreciate that. All right, next we got Greta Nicole in Dallas. She says, hi, guys. I'm listening to your Star Wars podcast, and I'm loving it. And it made doing the dishes go by really fast. So that's great. We're glad to be your entertainment to get you through those dishes, to get people through those work days. We like that. We like being a part of your routine. And hopefully, you know, you haven't run out of shows yet, Greta, because I know you just jumped in. But We'll fill up the queue here real quick with some new stuff. But thanks for listening. She's got some really cool artwork that she sells on eBay. So you guys need to go to her blog as well and check out some of her artwork. Then we got Ricardo Morgado Fiera. And excuse me if I butchered that, Ricardo. But and he's in Lips in Portugal. And he says, I really like what you guys are doing. Keep delivering the shows. You rock. And he's got a great picture up there of the 2001 poster with the Star Child on there. Jeff Beeching from Pompano Beach, Florida. Or Pompano, I don't know. Excuse if I'm blowing the regional pronunciation there. He says, a really enjoyable cast. Thanks for your hard work. Moving along, Richard Shirley from Carmel Valley, California. California. Have to say it that way. Sorry, it's the rules. But thanks for listening, Rich. James Stewart. From Manchester, England. And he says, hey guys, love the podcast. I'm a film student myself and am listening while storyboarding my latest effort. Oh, by the way, good call on putting Rennie Harlan in movie jail. Every one of his movies has bombed. He's got to go. Keep up the good work. Thank you, James. We are glad that you're a filmmaker and that you like the podcast. And we love it that a lot of our listeners are filmmakers, you know, and that's very cool, you know, to know that people who think like us are listening to our show. And yes, Rennie needs a break, doesn't he? So good call on that, too. Okay, Ron Lamar, or Lemaire, and he's from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And he didn't put a picture on there, but he put one in the photos section of the Frapper map. And so you can see him in there, and he's got a picture of him, and it looks like his lady on his arm there. And thanks for listening, Ron. Great shot of you there. Moving on to Chris in Atlantic Beach, Florida. He says, love the shows. Finally something on the radio for movie buffs. Dee Dee in Fairfax, Virginia. And she's got a great picture over there, if that's really her. Nice looking pic. And then we're going to wrap it all up with Darth Maltball. And he says, hey, are you guys from Houston? I heard you mention the Channel 13 Million Dollar Movie in the Recycle episode. And the answer to that is yes. John and I are both from Houston. We grew up in Houston. And as far as the Million Dollar Movie goes, man, I grew up watching that thing. And, it, you know, this would be movies, you know, on the ABC affiliate, and that was Channel 13 in Houston. And they would have movies on. So we'd come home, you know, after school, and you get to see a movie. And the cool thing was is that they were always themed. You know what I mean? You would get the Disaster Week or something like that. You know, that's where I'd see all my Irwin Allen movies. And God knows I saw, you know, Poseidon Adventure, you know, tons of times growing up. But that would be the situation. My favorite was always Jerry Lewis Week. I loved Jerry Lewis Week. And, you know, you'd always get the Nutty Professor and Cinderfella and all those movies. And, you know, as a kid, just seeing him do his shtick was just awesome. So, yeah, man, big lovers of that growing up. And so that's everybody for the Frapper Map for now. I'm going to go ahead and shut it down. Thank you guys for listening, for your support. You can always email us and get in contact with us that way at HollywoodSaloon@yahoo.com. We would definitely, definitely, definitely love some support over at Podcast Alley. You can vote for us just on our front page, HollywoodSaloon.com. Right on the left side, you'll see a blank where you can put in your email address, hit vote, and then they're going to send you an email, and all you got to do is confirm that email that it's you, and that'll be a vote for us. And our votes went down last month quite a bit, and, you know, but we expected that because, you know, we didn't put a show out. So, but if you guys could support us, that would be very good. That's how you pay us back. And Podcast Pickle, of course, too. Add us to your favorites there. And you can do all that right off any page of the Hollywood Saloon. You'll see the links either at the bottom or on the left side there. So please do that and support us at other places, too. Yahoo Podcast. They highlighted us on the front page of Yahoo Podcast real recently. And any kind of recognition like that, we always love to hear about. And if you ever hear about the Saloon on any other site, I know that someone told me recently that another Star Wars website, our podcast, said something about us. So that's always very cool. So if you ever see anything like that, let us know. But anyways, wrapping it all up, thank you guys very much for your continued support. Even though we weren't around for a while, we're back now and things will keep moving along. So thank you guys as usual, and we'll see you next time.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shore of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark nearly 10 hours a day. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears.
You're listening to The Hollywood Saloon.